Hey, you guys, movie retrospective time. One that Jenny is really, really, really excited about. Finally, I'm finally getting around to doing Eraserhead. I waited so long. Look, Tom got me this for Christmas, the Criterion Collection.
Yep.
And I just like been waiting. I kept putting it in the poll.
It's got a big book and everything.
I know. There's like a 60 something page book in there about it. It's like there's all kind of extras on it. It's awesome. But yeah, so I kept putting it in the poll like for the movie retrospective, and it never got the most votes, and I was just kind of like, God damn it. And then finally I said, okay, I'm going to put it in there one more time. If it doesn't win the poll this time, then I'm just going to do it by myself, like on my next, you know, in the movie thing that I'm starting next month. But finally, finally, you guys picked it. So I'm very, very excited to finally be talking about Eraserhead, because I feel like I don't do enough David Lynch on this show. I think I did Mulholland Drive, but I think I did that one by myself because that's when you were in Mississippi. But yeah, so Eraserhead probably... I mean, one of the cult movies of all time, really. It's kind of like, there was like a big retrospective of, I think it's a big book or something like that, talking about the midnight movie phenomenon, you know, like in the 70s and 80s, where movies would show every night or every weekend night, and people would come out in the middle of the night to see them. And it kind of talked about the six, you know, most classic, most famous midnight movies, of which Eraserhead was one. Obviously Rocky Horror Picture Show is in there, Pink Flamingos, you know, John Waters, and I think El Topo was one of them, The Harder They Come, and I can't remember what the other one was, but yeah, so this
Night
is
of Living Dead wasn't there?
Night of the Living Dead was in there, and I think there was one more, but I can't remember what it was. But yeah, so this is kind of like, this is one of those movies. It came out in 1977, and it first played in theaters, I think, when it premiered. You know, it didn't have a wide release or anything like that, because, I mean, David Lynch, this is his first full-length feature film. He'd made, like, several, you know, shorts before this, but he was still a film student when he first started working on this. You know, he was in his early 20s. And so it got kind of a limited release. I think the first showing it had in, I guess it was in L.A. or whatever, I think there was, like, 20 people, like, in the first screening. And it really didn't find its audience until it went on the midnight movie circuit and people kept going back and seeing it over and over again, trying to figure it out. And then it just got all this word of mouth, like, you have to see this fucking weird ass movie. And so then it just kind of like the cult of it grew out from then. And it's weird because Eraserhead was his first full length movie, right? And then because of the word of mouth about it and the buzz that it got, that one got him his second movie, which was the fucking Elephant Man, right? Because Mel Brooks ended up seeing Eraserhead and like was really impressed with it. And they, you know, they were trying to like work with David Lynch. Stanley Kubrick, before he was making The Shining, he told David Lynch, this is my favorite film of all time. And apparently he showed Eraserhead to the cast and crew of The Shining to like, this is the vibe that I want to get like in this movie. So this is like a massively, massively influential movie. You know, it's particularly in its like surrealism, its sound design is probably the most you know, the most influential thing, because that it was something that a lot of films didn't do back then. I think David Lynch was really kind of like a pioneer in these like bizarre ass like fucking kind of aural soundscapes, like to try to convey a certain sense of dread or this kind of overwhelming kind of shit. So all right, so I know like David Lynch is very love it or hate it kind of thing. Like you think this movie is just weird and it's not. You know what I'm saying?
Well, the movie is it's a weird movie about very mundane topics, and they use, I guess you could say, absurdist fucking imagery to take it emotionally over the top, to try to get you to feel a certain way about this subject. This subject is basically child rearing in a way.
Sort of. I mean, it's
family life or something.
Yeah. It's kind of like, I mean, at its heart, and you know, there's really no one interpretation of any David Lynch thing. It's just kind of like, you see what you want to see in it. But I think at its very basic, it's kind of not only about somebody that is obviously not ready for child rearing and not ready for, you know, settling down into a family life, just someone who's not ready for adulthood and the anxieties that go along with that.
Yeah.
But the thing about David Lynch is that he takes everything, he'll take something like that, but he puts it on film the way it would come about in a dream. Like, if you dreamed about those anxieties that you had, that's what he's trying to capture.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like an emotion that you can't really, access or express in your waking life, I guess. And like some shit comes out in your dreams and it doesn't seem like it means anything. But then later, if you think about it, it does kind of mean
something. It's not a dialogue driven movie.
No.
It's very imagery driven.
Yeah.
Symbolism driven.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Naked Lunch, but much weirder. Naked Lunch had a lot of dialogue in it to keep it going.
Yeah.
And this movie isn't very long, and it doesn't take place in very many places. It's visually pretty fucking weird, especially the little kid. You're like, what is that? You know?
No one knows. It's a mystery to this day. I have my theories about what it is. I think... Well, because let's talk about that. We don't even have to like talk about this in order or anything like that, because obviously it's Eraserhead we're talking about. So I don't know if you guys know, but there is kind of the baby in Eraserhead, you know, the deformed baby. It's kind of like legendary at this point that David Lynch refuses to say how they made that prop, how they made that baby. You know, he'll just say something real cryptic, like, oh, it was born, like, near where we were filming it, or, you know, we just found it somewhere, or something. I mean, obviously somebody made it, because it's articulated, like, it moves, its little eyes roll around and everything, and its mouth moves, but...
Looks like it was made out of something that was alive at one time.
I think so, too, because I think in 1977, well, actually, you know, this movie took, like, 5 years, like, off and on to make, because of the money, so it actually... was the early 70s when they first started working on it. And it, you wouldn't have got a special effect that good without using some real shit. And I suspect... Do you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the dead rabbit in Roman Polanski's Repulsion. Like, the rabbit that she's supposed to cook... And it's, like, in the fridge, and, like, as she starts losing her marbles and, like, it starts to rot because she's just trapped in this apartment for so long, it kind of reminds me of that. So a lot of people have said that maybe it's a skinned rabbit, or maybe it's, like, a lamb fetus, or maybe it's something like that that, that they stuck.
Looked a little bit like a fish to me.
That could be, too. But
a part fish. They changed the eyes on it. Might have been, like, a catfish head or something, and then they removed the lips. From the catfish.
Yeah.
Because they're usually on like a membrane. And then they change the eyes and put a different kind of eye in it. Because a fish would be easy to dry out and kind of plasticate and preserve so it wouldn't rot. I think it's a fish, maybe.
Yeah, because you would think, and I don't know, because like I said, this movie took like 5 years to make. And so obviously they couldn't have this rotting corpse of this, whatever this was, like hanging around on the set. Maybe they did all those scenes at the same time. I'm not really sure. But it's still like one of the creepiest like special effects ever. And I think it's even more creepy just because you don't know how the fuck they made it. Because it was obviously, like you said, it obviously looks like something that was alive. So, so the story of David Lynch, and like I said, this is not... Yes, the story matters, but it does have a story. It's not as inscrutable, I guess, as some people might perceive it to be. I haven't found
it's
all that inscrutable.
Kind of straightforward.
I thought that as well.
Yeah.
You know, so Jack Nance, obviously, who worked with David Lynch a lot, he was also in Twin Peaks later on. He kind of had a sad ending, actually. I might get into that, but so he plays Henry Spencer, and he's this dude who lives in this kind of industrial wasteland or something like that. It's actually meant to be, I think it's meant to be Philadelphia, because David Lynch spent a lot of time when he first married his first wife, Peggy, and they had a daughter, Jennifer, who later became a film director in her own right. But they had moved to Philadelphia. I think David Lynch is originally from Missouri, but they had moved to Philadelphia. They didn't have a lot of money, so they were living in this really like shitty, like crime-ridden neighborhood. And so I think that informed a lot of his earlier work. What I always thought was interesting was I always thought that the place that Henry lives, like in Eraserhead, I don't even know. It's not supposed to be a specific place, because like I said, it's almost like a dream landscape, but it's just like this gritty like industrial wasteland. I almost think that it's supposed to be like post-apocalyptic, because in his apartment there's a little framed picture on the wall of a mushroom cloud. And I kind of think that they're hinting that maybe like something has happened, but it's left nonspecific because it does really seem like a sort of, you know, post-apocalyptic wasteland. It's like there's no plants or anything. So he lives in this place. He works as a printer, but he's quote unquote on vacation. Now he finds out he's going back to his apartment and the woman across the hall who doesn't have a name in the, she's just called the beautiful girl across the hall. She comes out and says, hey, that girl that's always coming around, Mary, she just called and you're invited to her parents' house for dinner. So, you know, they want to talk to you. So he goes over to his girlfriend, Mary X's house. And it's pretty much the weirdest meeting the parents scene ever committed to film. It's just this really unsettling. It's just kind of like, that's what I mean about David Lynch taking anxieties that everybody can relate to. It's just like, oh my God, I'm having dinner with the girlfriend's parents for the first time or whatever. But like ramping it up to this absurd surrealist degree where it just becomes this kind of like living nightmare. I mean, the shit with like the mini chickens, you know, man-made chickens, but they're new. And like, he cuts into them and like blood comes out the butt of it. It's like all this other kind of shit. And then like fucking his girlfriend starts having a seizure and nobody says anything about it. It's just like the creepiest, weirdest shit. And there's like all this fucking weird ass noise. And like, there's this fucking dog is in there with all the puppies like suckling, and I don't know, it's just like the weirdest thing. I mean, the dad is like the with like the grin and everything. And then so they have this horrible nightmarish dinner, and then Mary's mom is basically says, have you and Mary had sexual intercourse? And so he's like, what the fuck, that's none of your business. And then they said, well, there's a baby. And then Mary's line there is so great. It's like, they don't even know if it is a baby. So she's in the interim between Henry and Mary. Because I was always of the impression that they had kind of not broken up, but they weren't really together anymore. Because when he first comes to the house, he says, I haven't seen you around in a long time or something like that. So I don't know how long it's been, but obviously she has had this deformed baby or whatever it is.
Maybe it isn't a baby.
In the meantime. Well, that's what she says. She says, you know, they don't even know if it is a baby. Yeah. And the mom is like, it's premature, but there's a baby and it's at the hospital. So it's basically, she's like, well, you guys have to go pick up the baby and then you have to get married and take care of the baby. And so that's what happens. So they all move into Henry's like tiny one room apartment. And this monster baby is just lays on the dresser and it makes this horrible, horrible noise, which I heard was, He had recorded his daughter Jennifer when she was a baby and used that for some, I mean, he altered it and shit like that, but he altered it like to sound so it would sound like super horrific. So she's in there, like Mary's in there and she's trying to like feed the baby and it won't eat. And it's like, you know, it just keeps crying and all this other kind of shit. And finally she's been putting up with it for a little while and she's just like, fuck this, I can't take it anymore. So she leaves the baby there with Henry. And Henry has no fucking idea how to do anything, how to take care of this baby. And then he starts like fucking around with the lady across the hall. And it's just kind of, there's all this bizarre, bizarre fucking, oh, and also there's like this big cheeked girl that lives in his radiator that sings to him and shit like that. But like I said, it's kind of like, it sounds crazy, like when you talk about it, like all the imagery, and it sounds like it doesn't mean anything. And it's like, oh, and at some point he has a dream where his head comes off and, you know, it kind of goes pop. And then like the baby's head comes out of there. And then his head like falls through this puddle. And then a little boy picks it up and takes it to a pencil factory. And they use his head to make erasers with, hence where the, you know, the title Eraserhead came from. But as I said, if you think about it, all of the imagery in this is kind of just on that side of, is, I don't know. It's like I said, to me, it doesn't seem all that strange, or it doesn't seem, I mean, it is strange, but it doesn't seem like it's that hard to figure out. I mean, obviously, you know, the very beginning where you first see Henry's head and then there's like the planet and then he has like that spermy thing like come out of his mouth, like that big long sperm creature, and then it falls into a puddle. And I mean, obviously the puddle is supposed to be the womb. That's, you're showing the conception of the monster baby or whatever. That's what that is. And then they kind of show it being born. And then you know, some of the other stuff, like I said, the woman that lives across the hall, that's just supposed to be like his lust or his lust for freedom, sexual freedom. Because like I said, this is, you know, a lot of people have made much of the fact that David Lynch first wrote this when he had had, him and his wife had had their daughter Jennifer in, I think, 67 or 68 or something like that. David Lynch was very, very young. And Jennifer had club feet when she was born that needed a lot of corrective surgery. So I think that you're kind of seeing, and I'm not saying that it's just like a one-to-one comparison of, you know, the fucked up baby was like his deformed daughter, because that's awful. But you can see where some of the ideas for this came from. It's like him being a very young man and, you know, suddenly his girlfriend or his wife, you know, he married her at the time. They were very, very young. They were both very creative. They were looking, you know, to kind of further their careers and stuff. And then all of a sudden, you know, they have a baby that they didn't expect because she was an unexpected pregnancy who has all of these medical problems. So you can see where that anxiety is coming from. Because a lot of the imagery in it, like I said, a lot of the sperm imagery, there's one scene where Henry has this little, it's not exactly like one of the little sperm creatures, but it looks like a little worm or something like that. And he puts it like in this box, like in his apartment, and closes it all up. And I think that is meant to represent like that's his, you know, his sexual desire, I guess, and he's kind of having to keep it locked away because he's married now and he has a baby and he has all these responsibilities, even though him and his wife don't really seem to have any connection, like I said, to one another. You know, they don't, she
going through the motions.
Yeah, he's just going through the motions because he had to. And I think that's kind of another thing too, where the weird scene where they're eating dinner with the parents, and, you know, the mom is like sitting there, like when Henry's cutting up the chicken and all the blood's coming out of the chicken. And then the mom's sitting over there, like making this really weird noise. And then her eyes roll back in her head and she starts like drooling and shit like that. And then she runs off into the kitchen, and then Mary runs off into the kitchen. And then the dad looks at Henry. He's like, she'll be all right. You know what I mean? So I think that they're kind of showing, you know, you settle down with the kid and the wife and everything like that, this is what you can look forward to. Like this poor dad that's like sitting here, like pretending everything's okay when it's not. Even though everything is just clearly like fucking off the rails, batshit crazy. But yeah, also I think there's also a lot of debate about what the lady in the radiator represents. I've seen three or four different interpretations, and pretty much any of them could be the case. I think that, you know, because there's a big thing too, it's like, why does the lady in the radiator have this big cheeks like that? Now, a couple of the interpretations I've seen, and any of these could be true, like I said, I think that the lady in the radiator having those big cheeks either means that she is an almost like grotesque, it's almost like a grotesque kind of thing of a smile. Like she has these big like creature, like she's supposed to be really, really like overly cheerful, like to a grotesque degree. Or I have seen an interpretation too, that because I kind of think that she represents death. She's like an angel. She's like an angelic figure. But I think that she represents death because I do think that he dies at the end, because there's one scene of her in the radiator. What I was going to say is that death is supposed to be like a little bit, as in the context of the movie, it's supposed to be alluring, but also kind of ugly. So I think that's kind of what they did, because she's obviously like a really cute girl, but then she has like these really weird, like big chipmunk cheeks. So they kind of made her look grotesque, but she's still cute. So, but there's one scene where they show her like on the stage, and she's like all these, the spermy creatures are like kind of raining down from the ceiling. And then she's like stepping on them and squishing them. And like all of the, you know, this white stuff is like popping out of them and stuff. So I think that she is, in a way, she's kind of saying, because her whole thing with the song, you know, the song In Heaven, Everything is Fine, she's trying to convince him that, you know, all you have to do is get rid of that baby and then everything will be fine and you can come to me and you'll be dead and all your problems will be solved. You know what I mean? So she is kind of trying to get, and I think that he sees that that's like the only way out. You know what I'm saying? Now, I have seen more I have seen more like cheerful interpretations that maybe she's like the embodiment of hope. And the fact that maybe the baby isn't even real at all, but it just kind of represents like his failure, his anxiety or fear about the future, and him killing the baby at the end is him getting over it, getting over his fear of the future, and like him embracing her at the end is, you know, saying, you know, the future is going to be bright or whatever. But I don't know. That could be, but I do kind of feel like maybe that's an overly, happy interpretation. I personally think that he dies at the end, but I don't really know. But like I said, it's not, you know, you can argue about it all day long, and people have been since 1977, because there are so many different interpretations of it that there's just no way, and he's not going to say, like, which
one. It's hard to believe that this came out the same time as Star Wars did.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like some people have pointed out, too, that the baby looks a lot like Admiral Ackbar.
Yeah.
So maybe a lot more people have been influenced by this than, like, than they have been. But, yeah, so as I said, what ended up happening with this? So David Lynch was still, like I said, a film student when he first started working on this. Now, he's a big fan of Franz Kafka, so you can see a lot of that influence. Oh, there's a box down there.
And yeah,
that's very small, Pokey. I don't know if he can fit in there. You know, so he's a big fan of Franz Kafka, and he said The Metamorphosis was like a big influence on Eraserhead. Also, a short story by Nikolai Gogol, The Nose, which was written back in the 19th century, and is about a dude whose nose jumps off his face and starts to go have like its own little life and adventures and whatnot. So he said that was a big influence too. But this wasn't actually supposed to be his first movie. He was supposed to do one, I think it was called Garden Back, because David Lynch started out as a visual artist. He's a painter, you know, still is. And so he started out doing films because he wanted to animate his paintings. So a lot of his early short films are like his paintings, but he's like animated them so they move. So he had done this painting of this like dude who's like a hunchback, and he had like all this, you know, all these trees and plants and shit like growing out of his back. And he wrote a script for this. But it was only supposed to, I think it was only supposed to be like 40, it was supposed to be 40 something minutes long or whatever. And his professors there were like, man, that, you know, for this idea, because I think the germ of the idea for Eraserhead was in there, because it had a couple named Henry and Mary. But theirs were about, this one was about adultery. It was kind of like, and it was supposed to be like the lust for the other women was supposed to be like represented by this insect that kept getting bigger and bigger. So that was kind of like the original story. But then they were like, well, you know, the instructors were kind of like, well, we don't know if this premise can, you know, be sustained over 48 minutes or however long it was supposed to be. And so there was kind of a big thing about that. And they're like, well, why don't you make, you know, Eraserhead instead? So we ended up making that. And I was going to say, so they ended up getting some of the funding from the American Film Institute, where he was going at the time. But because it took so long to get funding, and they kept running out of money and all this other kind of shit, you know, it took them like 5 years to do it. What they ended up doing, this is so funny to me. This just goes to show how somebody like David Lynch, I was reading something earlier today and it kind of stuck with me, where people kind of complain about not just David Lynch, but anybody that makes like experimental film or experimental art of any type. And they're just always like, well, you know, they're just making that to fuck with people, or they're just making that like to troll people, or as a joke, like to seem deep or whatever. But the fact that Eraserhead took 5 years to make, that he was able to sustain his interest in the project over 5 years, he actually took on a paper route. He delivered the Washington Post like in the middle of the night, like to help pay for this movie. And he got his parents and his wife's parents, they gave him money to help. So they all worked on this, and Jack Nance, who played Henry Spencer, his wife, Catherine E. Coulson, his first wife, who most people know was the log lady from Twin Peaks, she worked she got another job as a waitress and gave all of her tips to David Lynch to work on it. And she also trained on the crew, like she learned how to do a bunch of stuff around there, because, like I said, no one was getting paid on this shit. So the fact that he spent that much of his time, that much of his own money, and that a lot of the people on the crew were all in for it and, you know, would do it for no money and stuck with him all of that time. I mean, obviously that means that they believed in it. They had, you know, he felt like he had something to say that he wanted to get across. You wouldn't go to that much trouble just to make something to go, ooh, look how deep I am. You know what I mean? I just feel like that wouldn't happen. He really had something that he wanted to get across. But like I said, that's what I always kind of liked about David Lynch. Very famously too, Jack Nance and his ridiculous hairdo in this. Because this movie took so long to film, cat butt. Oh, Pokey. Look at her little butt.
She's crazy.
I'm totally leaving that in, too.
She's looking at it.
We're having a surreal David Lynch moment with a cat butt in there.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Jack Nance's ridiculous hairdo in the movie, because the movie, she's getting all mad. I'm going to have to start that over. Don't, please don't. Because if it's...
Oh my she's
God.
Nuts. Come on, come on.
She's like, what?
She jumped up there and there was nowhere to go.
Don't you want to see? Don't you want to see my butt?
Come here.
Aw, Pookie. Get down off there.
Nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go.
But yeah, so his ridiculous hair, so because this movie took so long to film, he had to have his hair like that for like 6 years. Because very famously, there's a couple shots. There's one shot in the movie where, you know, Henry opens a door and they said, well, the scene where he walks through the door, like into the room, it's like that was filmed like a year later. So the fact that they were able to sustain such a mood, even though it took that long to film, it's like they kept running out of money. And it's like, well, okay, we'll get more money. We'll film a little bit more on it. So the fact that it like just hangs together as well as it does and that nobody's like aged or anything like that is fucking crazy to me. Also, like I said, got to talk a little bit about the sound design, which is as much a part of this movie as any of the characters or the visuals even. David Lynch kind of known, he's very, very into the use of sound to like evoke moods, particularly dread. You know, so he was one of the first to kind of pioneer that sort of like, we're going to put like all this, you know, dread inducing, like industrial noise, like soundscapes, like in the background. He was one of the first people to do that. Also another, I guess it's not such a fun fact, but the dude that composed the In Heaven song, the Lady in the Radiator song, Peter Ivers, he was actually murdered and his murder is not solved, because I actually wrote about it in one of my books. So in case you didn't know. And also another sad fact is that Jack Nance, who played Henry, he actually died when he got into a fist fight with somebody in front of a Winchell's donut shop about what, I don't know. He said later, oh yeah, I guess I deserved it. He was hanging out with friends later that day and he had like a shiner, like a black eye. And then apparently they found him dead later on, like laying on a bathroom floor or something like that. He'd had all kind of internal injuries and he didn't know about it. So yeah, he got killed like in front of a fucking, isn't that fucking sad? I don't know. That's really sad to me. But yeah, so as I said, you know, we don't do a lot of David Lynch on here, unfortunately, because I still do want to do, shit, man, I got Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. I got to do the whole entire Twin Peaks series, which I'm going to do as soon as I watch all of them. I'm going to sit down and watch them all. I've seen the first two seasons, but I still haven't seen the third one because I just haven't had time to sit down and watch them. But I'll probably do that for my new movie review show. But I definitely want to do Eraserhead because I got it for Christmas. And it's probably one of my favorite experimental movies ever made. And like I said, it's not, you know, if you haven't seen it, it sounds crazy, like when you're telling people what actually happens in it. But it's pretty, I don't know, I just feel like it's pretty straightforward. Like the imagery, if you think about it for a few minutes, it's pretty straightforward. Even the stuff about like the whole dream sequence where his head pops off and the kid finds it and takes it to the pencil factory and they take the stuff out of his head and make pencil erasers out of it. I mean, to me, that seems like that's kind of like a metaphor for him wanting to erase the baby. Like he wanted to go back to before that had happened. You know what I mean? Because there was the whole thing where they take the pencil out with the new eraser on it. The guy draws a line and then erases the line. And then he says, oh, it's pretty good. Like it's, or it's okay. So he's just trying to say, I wanted to go back to before that happened. He wanted to erase the baby from existence. I mean, I thought that's what that was saying. Maybe, I don't know. Your mileage may vary. But yeah, so this
is it a baby? Or does it symbolize something else?
It's both or either. It could be a baby in a literal sense that...
Funny how the mom says they're not sure it's a baby.
Yeah, she's like, they're not sure it even is a baby.
Yeah. It stands for something else. It's got to.
Well, as I said, I've seen some interpretations that say that it could just stand for Henry's anxiety, that he's not ready for adulthood or he's not ready for responsibility. And that's just an easy way to symbolize it, you know, as a baby. But it's also a baby that doesn't act like a regular baby. Like, it won't eat. Yeah. It's, you know, it has those like fucking sores all over it. And he's like, you are sick. That fucking cracks me up. I don't know why. But, you know, so... And then the fact that it doesn't, I mean, he just kind of leaves it by itself all the time. It seems like it cries all the time. No one ever picks it up. It's just like a head. And when he cuts open the bandages at the end, it's like it doesn't have any skin.
It's just guts.
Like, it's just guts inside. So, like you said, it's, you know, yes, it's a baby in the sense that that's a very easy metaphor for, oh, you know, I'm saddled with this being that I have to take care of now. It just represents like responsibility and like he's not ready for it, which is also symbolized very neatly by, if you noticed in his apartment, like right by the mushroom cloud picture on the wall, there's a plant, or it's not really a plant, but it's like a branch with like a dead plant, and it's like in a pile of dirt. But it's not in a pot. And I think that maybe that might symbolize that he can't even take care of a fucking plant. So how is he going to take care of another person? You know what I'm saying? Because it's just kind of like, because when he has the dream sequence later with the baby head, like popping out of his suit or whatever, which, like I said, I think that's a pretty standard anxiety for, I think, thing for, you know, oh, I have kids now, my kids are going to replace me, or I'm not me anymore. And now I'm just, you know, the parent of this child, you know what I mean? Because your kids replace you, you die and they continue living. Usually that's how that works out. But so I think that's what that means. But in that dream sequence, the, you know, the pile of dirt plant that was next to his bed is big, and it comes like out on the stage, like on this little rolling dolly or whatever. So as I said, I think that symbolizes like his lack of nurturance, or his lack of ability to take care of something besides himself. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So I think that's all it is. I think it's just like a nightmarish fever dream about anxieties about not being able to take care of, or take any responsibility. You know what I mean? Especially for like, you know, a wife or a baby or whatever it is. You're just like afraid of adulthood. You're afraid of all the responsibilities that are going to come with it. So I think that's all that is, I think, but, you know, your mileage may vary, like I said, but I'd be interested to know if anybody else has any, interpretations, especially the lady in the radiator. I think she's Angel of Death. I think that she's his release, because once he gets rid of the baby and the baby's head comes back like really big and like starts flashing and everything. So he realizes that by killing the baby, he's only made the problem even worse. So then he feels like the only release now is death. So he goes in to be with the lady in the radiator, and she's just like, yeah, you did the good thing. It's like, you know, everything's fine now. But as I said, there are more optimistic interpretations of that. So I'd be interested to see if anyone's got any. But, you know, like I said, nothing's wrong. You know, none of the interpretations are wrong, because you can kind of like read whatever you want into it. But I have more of like a pessimistic reading of it, I guess. That was just the vibe I got. And I think too, it's instructive to, if you haven't seen Eraserhead for a long time, it's almost kind of like, I don't know if I'd say this necessarily. I don't know if Eraserhead is the best David Lynch to start with if you haven't seen it. I think it's better to like watch some of his later shit, because then you'll get a sense of his world and his proclivities and the way he goes about things, the way he uses symbols. And so I think that if you see something like, you know, if you watch Twin Peaks or if you watch Mulholland Drive or something like that, and then you go back and watch Eraserhead, I think Eraserhead will seem a lot more straightforward, you know, once you get a sense of like where he's coming from, because he uses a lot of the same themes and tropes and symbols across a lot of his work, because he has like a lot of the same obsessions, I guess. So sometimes it's helpful to see some of his newer stuff and then go back and watch his older stuff, and it seems a lot more clear. That said, I'd be really, really happy if someone would talk to me about Inland Empire, because I think that might be the only movie of his that I haven't entirely figured out yet. You know what I mean? There's some parts of that I've kind of figured out, but then some parts I'm just kind of like still working on. But I need to see it again. But I don't, you know, it's like 3.5 hours long. So it's kind of a time commitment. But, you know, so as always, let's continue the discussion down in the comments, because any other David Lynch people out there, I want to hear what you have to say about this movie and about any of his other movies, because you know how dorky I am about that shit, as I said on my Mulholland Drive review. And that'll do it for this movie retrospective. We will see you on the next one. Bye.